34. The Order Flow.
Milgram woke as some large vehicle groaned past in the street, or perhaps in dream, chains rattling. He'd slept with the windows open. He sat up and looked at the blank screen of Hollis's laptop on the cushioned ledge beneath the windows. The battery needed a charge, but she hadn't given him the charger. He guessed he had enough power left to check for Winnie's reply to his message of the night before. He'd intended to send Pamela the photos of Foley as well, and had bought the cable he'd need to do that. But after his conversation with Big End, he wasn't sure about Blue Ant's email system. He imagined Slight had been in charge of all of that. How complicated could that ultimately become for Big End? With no Neo and the laptop off, he had no way of knowing the time. The television suspended from the ceiling could tell him, he supposed, but he decided to shower instead. If it was time to go, Hollis would call him. The shower was one of those telephone handle arrangements, the stall largely conceptual. He brushed his teeth with one hand while rinsing his torso with the other, his battery-powered toothbrush loud in the small space. Toweling off, he thought of how Big Ant seemed to regard what was going on in Blue Ant as a sort of expected burn-off, like some brush fire on the Nature Channel, brought on by an otherwise essential excess of intelligence and ambition. He put on his new socks and underwear from Galerie Lafayette, and an unworn but creased shirt from Hackett. He remembered the Russians in the elevator. Foley. Winced. He tucked the memory card, with his pictures of Foley on it, down into the top of his left sock. He edged around the bed, stood looking down at Parisians passing on the sidewalk opposite. A graying, leonine man in a long dark coat. Then a tall girl in very nice boots. He looked for Fiona, half expecting to see her astride her motorcycle, keeping watch. He looked up then, but didn't see the penguin either. A tiny garret window popped open, on a building opposite, and a girl with short dark hair thrust her head and shoulders through, into the morning, a cigarette between her lips. Milgram nodded. Addictions were being serviced. He sat down on the padded bench and checked his Twitter. No Winnie. It was 7:05, he saw, earlier than he'd thought. He packed his bag, putting the laptop in last. What would he do once he'd returned it? How would he keep in touch with Winnie? The fact of Winnie made his knowledge of Blue Ant's internal brush fire feel awkward. Otherwise, he imagined, without her, it would mainly have been interesting, as Big Ant didn't seem particularly worried. Though he'd never seen Big Ant worried about anything. Where most people got worried, Big Ant seemed to become interested. And Milgram knew that that could be strangely contagious. Imagining explaining that to Winnie made him uneasy. He made a last pass for misplaced property, discovering one of his socks under the edge of the bed. He put it in his bag, put the strap over his shoulder, and left the room, leaving the door unlocked. Maids were afoot, but he didn't see them. Only their metal carts stacked with towels and tiny plastic bottles of shampoo. He saw the building's original stairway, winding down, beyond big, twisted, brown-stained timbers that couldn't possibly have been as old, in America, as they no doubt were here. He descended, passing windows on each floor, overlooking a courtyard the morning hadn't reached yet. Scooters and bicycles were parked there, at the bottom of a well of shadow. On the ground floor, he found his brief way around to the lobby, where china was rattling. No Hollis. He took a seat at a table for two, beside the windows, and asked for coffee and a croissant. The Tunisian waitress went away. Someone else brought the coffee immediately, with a small pitcher of hot milk. He was stirring his coffee when Hollis arrived, looking red-eyed and exhausted, the hound's jacket draped across her shoulders like a short cape. She sat down, a crumpled tissue in one hand. "Is something wrong?" asked Milgram. Seized by some substrate of his own childhood fear, sorrow, the cup halfway to his mouth. "I haven't slept," she said. "Found out a friend's been in an accident. Not in very good shape. Sorry." "Your friend? Not in good shape?"
He'd set the cup in its saucer. The waitress arrived with his croissant, butter, a miniature jar of jam. "Coffee, please," she said to the waitress. "Not a recent accident. I only heard last night."
"How is she?"
Milgram was having one of those experiences of feeling, as he'd explained to his therapist, that he was emulating a kind of social being that he fundamentally wasn't. Not that he was unconcerned with the pain he saw in Hollis's eyes, or with the fate of her friend, but that there was some language required here that he'd never learned. "He," corrected Hollis as her coffee arrived. "What happened?" "He jumped off the tallest building in the world." Her eyes widened, as if at the absurdity of what she'd just said, then closed tightly. "In Chicago?" asked Milgram. "It hasn't been Chicago for years," she said, opening her eyes. "Has it? Dubai." She poured milk into her coffee, her movements determinately businesslike now, precise. "How is he?" "I don't know," she said. "Flown to a hospital in Singapore. His leg. A car hit him. I don't know where he is." "You said he jumped off a building," said Milgram, sounding accusing, though he hadn't intended to. "He glided down, then opened a chute, came down in traffic." "Why?" Milgram shifted uneasily in his seat, knowing he was somehow off script now. "He'd need somewhere clear, flat, no wires." "I mean, why did he jump?" She frowned, sipped some coffee. "He says it's like walking through walls. Nobody can. But if you could, he says, it would feel like that. He says the wall is inside, though, and you do have to walk through it." "I'm afraid of heights." "So's he, he says. Said. I haven't seen him for a while." "Was he your boyfriend?" Milgram had no idea where this came from, but his therapist had had a lot to say about his relative inability to trust certain kinds of instinct. She looked at him. "Yes," she said. "Do you know where he is?" "No." "Do you know how to get in touch with him?" "I have a number," she said, "but I'm only supposed to call it if I'm in trouble." "Aren't you?" "I'm unhappy now. Anxious. Sad. That's not the same." "But do you want to stay that way?" Milgram felt as though he'd become his therapist, in some weird role flip, or rather Hollis's. "How can you expect to feel better if you don't find out how he is?" "You should eat that," Hollis said, sharply, indicating his croissant. "We have a cab coming." "I'm sorry," he said, feeling suddenly miserable. "It's none of my business." He fumbled with the paper seal on the lid of the tiny jam jar. "No, I'm sorry. You're just trying to help. It's complicated for me. And I haven't slept. And I'd been managing not to think about him for quite a while." "You were good last night with Meredith," Milgram said, tearing his croissant in half and troweling butter and jam inside both pieces. He bit into one of the halves. "Now, I don't know whether I can go on with that. I have to find him." "Call him." "Not knowing is affecting your work. That's trouble." "I'm afraid. Afraid that might not work. Afraid he might not want to hear from me." "Use Hubertus," Milgram said, around a mouthful of croissant, covering his mouth with his hand. "He can find anyone." Her eyebrows rose. "Like Meredith's sneakers," he said. "The price of admission." "Meredith's sneakers wouldn't be unhappy to be found by Hubertus. My friend would be unhappy to be found by anyone. Would he have to know?" "Did you learn to think this way from Big End?" "I learned it being an addict, constantly requiring something I wasn't legally allowed to possess, and which I couldn't afford. I learned leverage. What you did last night, with Meredith, you could do that with Hubertus, and find your friend." She frowned. "There was someone here last night," he said, "from Hubertus, after you went up." "Who?" "Fiona. A girl on a motorcycle. Not someone I'd seen at Blue Ant. Well, I'd seen her, on her motorcycle, delivering something for Pamela. But I didn't know she was a girl. Why was she here?" "So that I could speak with Hubertus, on her phone. He told me that Slide is either working for or with someone else. He told me that I should regard everyone other than Pamela and Fiona as suspect. And you. He said you didn't know about it. But you do now." "How did he seem to be taking that?"
"He seemed interested. He wants you to take a cab to your hotel when we arrive. Fiona will take me to meet him then."
"Isn't she in Paris?"
She'll be on the train we take.
He cultivates this stuff, she said. Makes sure it's in the mix. Hires people who will go off the reservation, lead him somewhere new.
Harnessing chaos, Gareth said.
Who's Gareth?
My friend. He enjoyed hearing about Hubertus. I think Hubertus made a lot of sense to him. I thought it might be the jumping-off thing, that Hubertus erects his life and his business in a way guaranteed to continually take him over the edge, guaranteed to produce a new edge he'll have to go over.
He believes that stasis is the real enemy, Milgram said, glad to put any space at all between himself and Hollis's moment of crossness. Stability's the beginning of the end. We only walk by continually beginning to fall forward, he told me, remembering, that that would be the problem with being able to perceive the order flow, the potential for stasis.
The what?
The order flow. He was talking about secrets once, in Vancouver when I first met him. He loves secrets.
I know, said Hollis.
But not all secrets are information people are trying to conceal. Some secrets are information that's there, but people can't have it.
There where?
It just is, in the world. I'd asked him what piece of information he'd most want to have, that he didn't have, if he could learn any secret. And he said that he'd want something nobody had ever been able to have.
Yes?
The next day's order flow. Or really the next hours. Or the next minutes.
But what is it?
It's the aggregate of all the orders in the market. Everything anyone is about to buy or sell, all of it. Stocks, bonds, gold, anything. If I understood him, that information exists at any given moment, but there's no aggregator. It exists constantly, but is unknowable. If someone were able to aggregate that, the market would cease to be real.
Why?
She looked out the window, over the taut black wire supporting its gray linen curtain.
Our cab's here.
Because the market is the inability to aggregate the order flow at any given moment. He pushed his chair back, stood, and popped the last of the croissant into his mouth. Chewing, he bent and picked up his bag. He swallowed, then drank off what was left of his coffee. I'll give you your computer on the train. She was leaving some change on the tablecloth.
You can have it if you need it.
But it's yours.
I bought it 3 months ago, thinking I might start another book, she said, standing. I've opened it about 3 times. I have a little email on it, but I'll put that on a thumb drive. If I need a computer, Blue Ant can pay for it.
She started for the desk, where she'd left her bag. Milgram followed, order flow forgotten in his surprise at being offered such a gift. Since he'd been with Hubertus, he'd been provided with things, but they all felt like equipment. It wasn't personal. Hollis was offering him something that he'd thought of as hers. And she'd already given him her art book, he remembered. He could read more of it on the train to London. They gave their keys to the man at the desk and went out to the waiting cab.